It is time for another Techie Talk with State Representative Techie Chan of Quincy to chat about all things state and local and Quincy. Hi, Techie.
Hey, good morning, Joe. Happy Wednesday morning.
I know. Here we are, the last full week of January. Hard to believe.
Yeah, it's been like a month forever because, it started on a Saturday and ends on a Monday. So it does seem like an unusually long month.
It's one of the few months with 31 days. Yeah, exactly.
So, hope you're doing well, and we're bracing for another storm perhaps this weekend.
Yeah, it is winter, and we were bound to get something, so at least it's on a Saturday.
Yeah, agreed. Also, be hopeful that it limits some travel this weekend, and schools will be open because it looks like it's going to be a Friday evening storm. But I think it'll slow some people down on traveling around this weekend, given the fact Omicron is on the decline. But it's still, still moving around the community.
No question. But things are going in the right direction. There's at least a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, hopefully.
Yeah, very similar to the Delta wave. There is eventually a point where there's no one more to infect, and the virus has nowhere else to go. And as a result, it goes down. And if you're vaccinated and you've had Omicron, your odds of getting Omicron decline. Because your resistance is higher. There's no guarantees, folks, that you can't get it. It's just your odds improve. So I like to keep reminding everyone, your odds get better. And if you are vaccinated and boosted, or even just vaccinated, your odds are still better on not getting it as well. But it's not like it invites anyone to get Omicron. I've not heard of anyone tell me this has been fun who have gotten sick. I've not heard one person tell me they would invite this on themselves or anyone else.
Yeah, I've heard the same. I've talked to folks who have gotten it. And, although it's described as quote unquote mild, it's still not fun.
Yeah, it's like, why would you invite yourself to get sick?
So, Tacky, we are recording this on the day after the governor's State of the Commonwealth address. What's your reaction to that?
This is not my first end of a governor's cycle address. I was running for Governor Deval Patrick's end of cycle address actually 8 years ago now, I think. And as you all know, I've been around a year or two and watched more than a few governor's addresses towards the end of a term. Obviously, governors always talk to your achievements going into a state of the state address. And he can talk a lot about 7 years worth of achievements and, of course, the challenges of COVID we live in today. And working with the legislature, he's correct. We did some incredible things involving green energy, actually more than one time we explained green energy, climate change related bills, bills regarding things like workforce training and education, and we did the massive funding reform on K-12 that we did last session. We work on issues like gun violence and domestic violence we have, and obviously the governor wants to do more work in domestic violence, which is very important. And there's a lot of things that we were able to move the needle forward with Governor Baker. And the question is how much further does he want to move his needle in the remaining time he has? Everyone knows the term lame duck. I mean, it's not like anyone watching doesn't know that. But the governor's ability to work with the legislature, even when we're in disagreement, doesn't prevent us actually trying to get some issues moved forward. So even though he's in a position where he's not running for re-election, the relationships he built over the last 7 years still does have value right up to end of his time. And I can't speak definitively on how the legislature will move or not move any parts of his agenda. But I will say that the communication with membership and leadership with the governor and the governor's office will not change in the way we operate.
You did talk a little bit about proposing some tax cuts for some of the low-income earners, also some help for rents and also property taxes for older folks. How do you feel about all that?
Well, it's easier to make bigger ideas when you're not going to be around to deal with the consequences if nothing happens, right? This is just a reality check, guys. So obviously the legislature is now put in a hot seat again. We've had the discussion regarding the ARPA money last year, for example, putting legislation in a hot seat on moving governor's agenda would be very popular with folks. And of course, the legislature has its own independent review regarding governor's proposals, which may not be popular with folks. in the end. But this is why we have separation of powers, right? So, you know, they will prevent an argument, and we ourselves will do our own homework and present an argument and see where we are. Again, we also have a very different Republican Party in Massachusetts. I mean, you would not find many Republicans around the country talking about, you know, property tax relief, talking about helping the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, talking heavily about promoting people's rights, whether it be voting rights or reproductive or civil. You know, the Republican Party in Massachusetts is very different from other states. And Governor Baker does reflect a lot of those principles that I believe move across the majority of folks in Massachusetts. So, as I like to say, I mean, we haven't seen all the ideas on the table. We will be seeing some of these quickly. I know that he's filed a few bills, but I fully expect Governor Baker will file a lot more bills this year than he has in the previous ones as he's trying to get his agenda done. And also remember that he got waylaid by COVID. COVID basically cost him 2 years of filing bills to push forward his own agenda. And that's hard. I mean, when you think about it, right? I mean, your four-year term, you know, you try to get a few more things done, and you lose two of those years to COVID, essentially. So, you know, he's going to try to cram together as much as he can in the time remaining on agenda items they would like to have get done if we had more time in a much truncated period as he moves into the final year.
Yeah, something he talked about that I wasn't aware of is this some kind of a loophole allowing essentially battered women to be victimized by their abusers, either psychologically or physically. Are you aware of that?
Well, well, there's some provisions in he talked about yesterday regarding kind of indirect abuse, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, online stalking, revenge porn, a couple of things, dissemination of information over the internet, basically a new way of doing rumor mill gossip, right? I mean, I'm fully aware in social circles that if you're a domestic violence victim, your abuser will malign you among your peers in your community, in your neighborhood, in your church, in your school, doesn't matter where it is. You know, they'll malign you inside community lines to ostracize you from the rest of the community and cause a greater power by the abuser onto the victim because of ostracization by the remainder of the community. And this is more common people realize. But with the introduction of the internet and social media and how we engage each other on a communal level on the internet, that ostracization becomes very, very more pronounced, especially now you're also reaching out to strangers.
Yeah, we're seeing it among young people too, right? It's some of it is what led to some of the student walkouts, even here in Quincy.
Well, it's hard to dismiss. I think people who are dismissive of this kind of internet-based communication are thinking in a different time period. Mm-hmm. And even in a different time period, the idea of social ostracization and not addressing people's issues directly is, quite frankly, primitive and behind modern thinking by any stretch. Just because you may have found it acceptable or ignorable 40 years ago does not mean it's acceptable today. And because you knew it was wrong then, you just didn't want to say it because you say the words, well, that's how things are. Well, just how things are is how people continue to get beaten. Yeah. So, you know, moving the step forward is to acknowledge that, you know, it was wrong then, it's still wrong now. And you may reflect now realizing it was wrong then, even though the medium has changed and how it happens, doesn't mean that it's the badness is, it's not still bad. I mean, it is bad.
Yeah. So do you think there's some kind of a way the state can address that in legal counsel?
I'm not sure exactly how this is going to work yet. I've not delved heavily into the governor's proposal. I mean, a lot of things can be part of a factor regarding restraining orders. Domestic violence victims in particular have special restraining order circumstances, but I am also aware that restraining orders versus spouses versus restraining orders versus a couple, a non-spouse couple, are two different types of restraining orders. You know, are things such as online stalking, online commentary, part of the factors associated with it? And can you do restraining orders against people from continuing that behavior? As we all know, that's kind of hard to keep track of. You have to stay right on top of it. I do have, actually, we talked about this with Mark Crosby about my very, very, I won't say it's a very well-written bill because I'm not going to admit it's going to be well-written. I have a very loose idea bill about, you know, holding some people accountable for slander associated with using the internet. So social media to slander someone, you should be held some accountability if it really is slander. Because a lot of slander stuff really is what we call tabloid news, right? People sue the National Enquirer on a regular basis, trying to get past the First Amendment rights to prove that the paper wasn't actually reporting, but the paper was just slandering it, right? So, you know, people aren't afforded the same rights as a newspaper. Sorry, folks, you have First Amendment rights, but newspapers have different First Amendment rights pursuant to the Supreme Court. But, you know, you can still, but everyone can still be held responsible at some level. It's proven that, you know, falsehoods are speaking for the intended true purpose of harming an other economically or socially, or socially that affects their livelihoods. So, no, I think it's trying to modernize this type of abuse, stalkery, this type of engagement from behind a computer screen or behind your phone. It'll be interesting to see how we try to manage to incorporate modern technology into our traditional way of thinking regarding this type of behavior.
Yeah, it's, I can see the challenges though, because of the, you know, anonymity of the internet, right? I mean, you can create a fake persona, a fake email, a fake identification, and then, you know, proliferate that kind of abuse and go undetected.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's up to, you know, the accuser and the accusee to try to figure out, you know, who did what to whom. And but at the same time, I think the impact on, we talk about this about social media a lot, but I think the impact of social media, particularly among friends and abuses, is very challenging. And let me frame it this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, people tend to be supportive of your friends in any type of spousal situation or accompanying situation. I mean, you would be supporting the person closest to you. Mm-hmm. But the way internet changes how social circles operate, the damage can be much further wider than within your social mm-hmm. circle.
And absolutely. Can have lifelong implications, sure, yeah.
And it can move beyond just your immediate friends and move into ancillary or colleagues and so forth. And it gets really complicated really quickly regarding the size of the circle that moves out of. And I think that was the governor was talking a little bit yesterday during his state of state. We're looking to see if we can somehow figure out address some of these issues associated with the determination of domestic abuse, especially in a modern way of doing it, that beyond how we, most of us traditionally think of what domestic abuse looks like. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not an easy challenge, not an easy issue for sure. So, but I guess, I think it's worth talking about at least.
Oh, absolutely. It is something that the legislature will definitely talk about. And, you know, as you kind of move forward, I know there's a session ends on July 31st, but you know, as we move forward, I mean, this conversation will continue, we'll keep moving forward. As we like to say, we can't chew gum and walk at the same time in this place.
One thing at a time, right?
sometimes two things at a time.
Yeah.
We manage that. So, you know, we'll see how it progresses and goes along. I suspect it's going to go to the Joint Committee on the Judiciary, which I suspect it's going to be addressed first. And then mm-hmm. we'll see what the chairs say on that and take it from there.
Okay. All right, very good. What's happening on the Hill this week? It's budget time. Actually, today is governor's budget presentation, right?
Yes, there should be a press conference with the governor unveiling his budget at some point today. Generally, it's done after lunchtime. But then again, I mean, how things should be done isn't the way it has to be done. I only tell you what I know based on what I've seen before. What they say before doesn't mean it happens today, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly the scheduling. But generally, it's around lunchtime or after lunchtime zone that they do that. So, you know, there's been a consensus revenue figure about $39.6 billion, I think, which is about 2.7 larger than last budget cycle. And that's the number the governor is going to hold himself to. Obviously, this number can be tweaked slightly depending on new projections as we move forward in the year. As we get close to April on the final tax collections for FY 2022, Two, that can help forecast FY23.
Yeah.
So we'll see what the governor's priorities are for this. Again, it is a recommendation. Do not get too excited to be in the governor's budget. But it's a good start for the House and Senate to, you know, weigh in what he thinks, and then we'll weigh in what we think as we move along.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. And a lot of the proposals he put on the State of the State address should be reflected in this budget. So if he's looking to do any kind of tax adjustments or any type of other relief taxes or programs that helps provide some relief, especially property taxes, if there are programs, particularly for seniors, veterans, and persons with disabilities, yeah. Tax relief on property, taxes. I don't know if he's going to try to expand some of those programs or propose a new program, but taxpayers will have to provide some obviously funding to make these tax offsets work. So we'll probably get some ideas through the governor's budget of stuff he talked about last night on what the cost would be to Commonwealth, as well as how it could be implemented.
Yeah, you mentioned the ARPA money. I know that he's planning to file a separate transportation bond bill too. Is that right?
Actually, I'm a little surprised as a transportation bond bill, folks. Oh. We approved a $13 billion transportation bond bill 2 years ago, which is the largest bond bill I've ever seen in my lifetime, because the governor wanted to go big and bold, ranging from commuter rail, MBTA-ish type stuff, to roads and bridges, to forward to Bedford, commuter line. I mean, it was a monstrous bill. I mean, it you name it, it's something in there. Yeah. So I was actually a little surprised that he said it'll be another transportation bond bill filed shortly and directly related to the ARPA funds. Just because we approve bond bills doesn't mean all the money in the bond bill is spent. Mm-hmm. So just let everyone know. So just because you approve $13 billion, doesn't mean we're spending $13 billion. I think people need to understand that. And the bond bills do have an expiration date. They're only good for X period of time. Once the X period of time has ended, the authorization from the legislature ends and the bond bill authorization vanishes. So unless we approve $5 billion bond bill and we put a 5-year expiration on the bond, then after 5 years, if the governor does not use any of the $5 billion, all $5 billion authorization is taken away.
Oh, all right.
So, we do float a lot of bond authorizations, but it doesn't mean, one, they're going to be all spent. And secondly, it doesn't mean that he's going to spend in time within authorization. And whomever the new governor is will be subject to the same constraints on these authorizations. And so it's a little bit trickier than I think people realize regarding bond bills, because it's just because you authorize them, you're going to spend the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And you actually mentioned last time about the capital bond bill that the governor filed about the judiciary. And there are some capital projects within that bond bill that does small projects in various courthouses, ranging from elevators to staircases to roofs, the general maintenance of buildings. So he has that bond bill out there, which when you look at it really carefully, really is a maintenance bond, but it's a capital maintenance bond. But trying to do, like doing an elevator replacement is a capital upgrade, right? You got to do a mass amount of HAV system, capital upgrade. Those are done through bond bills. So the governor has that bond bill out there. He'll file a transportation bond bill as well. My understanding is an economic development bond bill on the way as well. So we have a lot going on. Plus, the $2+ billion in ARPA road and bridge money sitting, plus whatever we get from the Fed's transportation infrastructure bill, which we may have some control of in the legislature, plus potentially a legitimate good-sized surplus for FY22, plus the FY23 budget. Who knows what's going to be available more from the federal government as well down the road. We don't know, depending on how they get their act together down there. So some of it, is cash spendable, and some of it is a bond authorization. Mm-hmm. So, we'll wait and see what the governor files on that transportation bond. I'm actually very interested to see how that works out and how it ties to the federal infrastructure money. If there's matches we'd have to follow up that's outside of the larger bond bill we approved last session.
Okay. How does it work, Tacky, when you approve a bond? Is the whole amount borrowed at once, or is it only borrowed in increments up to that amount?
It's in increments.
Okay.
So the state has a capital bond budget the governor sets, and we do have a self-imposed debt cap. So we have actually two types of caps. We have the overall borrowing cap, on the state, which I think it's been a long time now that I think about it. I've not asked this question in a long time, like 4 years, but I mean, it's close. When I'm getting myself in trouble, I think it's close to about $20 billion that we're allowed to have outstanding debt at one time, okay. Which sounds like a lot, but when you weigh against a budget, it's over $50 billion. It really isn't.
Right.
Our debt budget generally stays under 6%. Most times we try to keep our debt payments of the total budget to less than 6%, you know, closer to 4 or 5 is preferable. And then the governor's office has its own self-imposed bond cap that it spends on an annual basis and is budgeted on an annual basis. So the bond cap, you know, is about $2+ billion a year to borrow. So, you know, no different from anybody else. As we borrow money, we're also paying off old debt at the same time. When interest rates were low, there was a massive refinance. Big surprise. Like a lot of folks, when interest rates took a massive dip, refinancing did occur at our level to get the best interest rates possible for the taxpayers who want the best interest rates possible. Mm-hmm. And the governor will borrow from different bond bills incrementally. And it'll be incremental over projects. So if a project takes 5 years, you're not taking the entire bond money for that 5 years in year one. Okay. You budget it over 5 years. And subsequent governors inherit bond authorizations, meaning that the new governor, they'll be in next year, will be saddled with the previous governor's ongoing capital projects.
Okay.
Because, you know, you've got a 10-year project and you could have potentially three governors, for example, in a 10-year time span, depending on when things start and things end, you know, managing a 10-year project. So that part of the budget, bond budget, is, you know, has already been set aside.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah. So the legislature, for example, you know, obviously we put a lot of things in bond bills and we advocate with the governor's office to put it inside their budget at some point in the future to address capital projects that are important to us. So it's a little bit different from the municipal level where you guys all see the city council approve their bond authorizations and pretty much the executive branch, the mayor's office, spends that bond authorization, you know, within the time frame asked, approved by the council. And they will spend the entire bond authorization. The state does not. We do not spend entire bond authorizations. And even we have large authorizations, the governor's offices since Bill Weld has been doing self-imposed bond budget caps, meaning they're not just spending whatever. They try to withhold themselves within a budget amount adjusted by CPI.
Okay. And
that has been a tradition. We do have a couple, you know, circumstances a little bit peculiar, I think people should know. I mean, the Chapter 90 funds that we approved from the last bond bill, which is a very small one for just Chapter 90 for season towns to get some assistance under local roads and bridges, that's actually outside of the bond cap, that's outside of the state debt service cap. The state taxpayers statewide is subsidizing municipal taxpayers on their local road bridge project through direct grants. You know, another example is things like I think scuba assistance funds a little bit quirky because that's direct cash payments from the budget to cities and towns for offsetting their debt amounts associated with new school construction, for example. You know, that actually is a cash payment on that front from our standpoint and helping out cities and towns. I'm trying to think of any other programs where we absorb debt on behalf of municipalities. There has to be a few more out there. I just can't think of them right now.
Okay.
We'll borrow the money, but the city and town benefits from it.
Right.
But, okay. You know, municipal taxpayers don't pay for it, but statewide, meaning us, you know, municipal plus the entire state, will pick up the costs, subsidize the community. And Quincy is one of those cities that pretty much has benefited from a lot of state assistance. So some person in, you know, Wareham is paying for the Quincy project, right? That's how that works.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, we'll have to send them a thank you.
Yeah, exactly. It's like also MWRA is another classic example of that. I mean, they also have independent bonding ability. And it's always been explained to me that people get upset about that in different MWRA communities. But since capital improvements have to occur through the whole system nonstop to maintain the water, sewage, safety, and nowadays security upgrades, you know, what they do in Quincy, you know, someone at Wayland's paying for, but some town on the road 10 years later, Quincy folks are paying something in Wayland.
Yeah.
It's a continuous endless cycle of capital improvement projects. So, but it benefits the whole system, and ratepayers in every system are constantly across subsidizing each other on projects to make sure the system is safe and secure.
Yeah. Okay. How do you think about the marijuana tax revenue, Jackie, exceeding alcohol tax revenue?
Not surprised, to be honest with you. The marijuana tax revenue is tied to the price of marijuana itself. And given the fact that marijuana growing isn't keeping up with demand, mm-hmm. well, the price is going to be high. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic has shown that people like their marijuana as much as like their beer. So I think there'll be more price adjustments to marijuana as supplier increase over time. And I think that's the thing we're waiting for, because I've actually visited a marijuana growing facility before. It's small in the sense that it's very contained, high security, high ventilation, fire suppression systems, all kinds of hazmat-ish type of cleanliness issues. I mean, it's very involved in terms of maintaining a safe product and high security on securing this product. And it does take time for these plants to grow and have to grow in specific conditions. And you can only have only one gender of the plant actually produces the substances you need. So there's always a percentage of the product that is irrelevant once it comes to food growth. It's not usable.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I'm trying to now remember the spot quizzing again. It's been a little while since I was in the marijuana committee, but I think it's the female side. I'm sure someone's going to comment I'm wrong. But I think it's female side of the plant, I think it needs to, that bloom has to come up.
Yeah, okay.
So there's always a percentage loss of product no matter what when you grow it. And you can't, and the margin of error growing is very, very low, meaning you have special conditions, specific feed, specific water, specific light.
Oh, yeah.
Because besides the gender loss issue in the plants, you don't want any natural loss, plus you don't want any introduction of outside, fungi or bacteria or other things that may harm these plants. So it's not like conventional agricultural growing. People think marijuana farms is like this green field. No, it's really done in warehouses, in controlled environments that needs to do year-round growing.
Yes. Yeah. I've actually seen the one up at Rishubi Drive, the medical dispensary, and it's quite an involved process.
Yeah. I visited one, I think in Franklin. It's been like 2017, so it's been a while since I visited. Once I can't remember where it was, but yeah, it was a fascinating couple of hours of just learning how this all works and showing us how much technology is now involved on working. Like they tell you exactly how much each plant's water is, what the soil water content is. They know what nutritional level is in the soil itself. It is amazing. So of course, it's expensive to do this, which means the price of getting out into the public is going to be expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The logic, of course, is that if we have more supply and demand, we'll eventually iron out and it will, iron out the price, which can also iron out the taxes.
Right. Yeah. There's a proposal for a dispensary here in Quincy, you might be aware of too, down at the Four River Bridge. So the city, I'm sure, is hoping to get some kind of a host agreement out of that and take some tax revenue.
Yeah, that is very attractive to folks that it's tied to that. Also, I found out actually interesting conversation this week about marijuana licenses tied to alcohol licenses. So X number of alcohol licenses gets you X number of marijuana licenses.
Oh, okay.
It follows a ratio, which I do not know what memory it is right now, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But I mean, with the census changes around the state, there have been some more alcohol licenses provided to certain communities, whether a sufficient number of licenses have been provided to those communities where it elevates them to the next level of getting a marijuana license varies from town to town. Hmm. So we'll see. Just because they have available licenses for marijuana doesn't mean you have to actually issue them all.
Right. Yeah.
Municipality has the option. Same with the alcohol license. Municipality is not required to issue all the alcohol licenses. Mm-hmm. They can hold back on them if they don't feel the need to issue anymore. So we'll see how that process goes. And, the city towns have some flexibility regarding municipal approval process for marijuana. Yep. I mean, we provide the state overarching way of going about it. Obviously, you can't violate state law, but there's a little bit of flexibility on the local level, including, as you pointed out correctly, the host agreement.
Right. Yeah. And then there's some designated zones specific to where those businesses can locate, at least here in Quincy.
You can control the zoning as long as it doesn't create zoning in a matter that intentionally locks a business out of your community.
Right. What do you think about this bill, Tacky, to allow illegal immigrants the ability to obtain driver's licenses?
This is not a new issue. This thing's been kicking around since the days I worked for Michael Morrissey. Everyone thinks like it's a brand new thing. It really isn't. It's been a conversation ongoing in every state for quite a while now. And, you know, more than a few large states have moved forward on this, which I believe include California, New York, and Connecticut, they think. The problem is they make me think off the top of my head of these kind of data sets. Sometimes I get them, sometimes they don't. So the short of it is that undocumented immigrants should undocumented immigrants get a driver's license. And I use the word undocumented, not illegal. And people are just very confused. And it actually is very simple in a very confusing way. It's illegal when the court says it's illegal, not when you and I say it's illegal. So what's the example? The example is that you commit a crime, any crime. Let's say jaywalking. Let's pick a simple, harmless crime. And you're brought in, you're going to fight the charges and go in as a defendant. And the judge rules that in your favor. You did something illegal to us in the public, but the judge rules that you're acquitted. You weren't found jaywalking, despite, let's say, all the evidence to the contrary.
Okay.
Well, it's not illegal, is it? Because you weren't convicted.
Okay. Gotcha. That's the legal process. Yeah, exactly.
Legal and illegal is an individual impact, not a group impact. You know, even in crimes involving multiple individuals, involved in the same crime can have different charges.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may be charged with murder. You may be holding a knife, but there isn't enough there for the jury or the judge in a reasonable doubt that you did it, you know, then it's not illegal.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean the action didn't happen.
Okay. Just in the eyes of the law, it's not illegal. Yeah.
Same thing with immigration issues. You're undocumented means that your documents are not up to date or you don't have documents showing you you're supposed to be here. Whether you're illegal is up to a judge to decide if you're illegal.
Okay. All right. I'm glad you clarified that because I never heard it explained like that before.
Well, an immigration judge can make you undocumented, documented, and you were never illegal to begin with.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
Because a judge could do that. The immigration judge could issue an undocumented individual documents on the spot at the end of the hearing, in a trial, and say, you know, okay, your case makes sense. We're going to document you. You know, go get processed, right? I'll give you another simple example. Visa renewals. I discovered this during COVID because COVID screwed up everything, as we all know, regarding every kind of documentation known to man.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to get driver's licenses. And people with legal visas can get driver's licenses. There's actually a list of types of visa. Not every visa entitles you to a driver's license. For example, student visas, not all student visas get you a driver's license, right? It's actually country by country that could get that. For example, Massachusetts and Taiwan have reciprocal driver's license. So if you got a Taiwanese driver's license, you can get a Massachusetts driver's license, and even if you earn a student visa. But if you're, let's say, from a country with no reciprocal license and you're here on a student visa, that doesn't mean you get a driver's license.
Okay.
It's very interesting, right? Mm-hmm. So we've had people whose visas have expired and they're waiting for renewal. They are now undocumented.
Oh, I see. All right. Because it's expired. Yeah. Okay.
But they're not illegal.
Right.
They're not illegal. And this actually happens more common than they think people listening realize. Where bureaucracy gets in the way, death in the family gets in the way. I've had one constituent case where there was a fire and burned it. Their documents were burned. So they couldn't prove documentation and they had to get new documents and they need to get a driver's license. And they were waiting for that and they couldn't get a driver's license because it doesn't allow for no undocumented folks. So for example, in an expired visa license or expired visa, even demonstration of application renewal isn't enough in Massachusetts for you to get a driver's license. So if my visa expired, COVID hits, you know, backed up insanity regarding renewal process, it's already painful enough as is. You guys can all imagine dealing with the bureaucratic associated of federal bureaucracy in particular. And you're now waiting like 4 months and you can't get a renewal license. You can't go to work.
I see. Okay. Yeah. I think it's when people hear illegal, they think, you know, a criminal who snuck over the border, committed some kind of a crime, is living with a gang somewhere in a dark alley. I think that's what's conjured up when you hear that term.
Well, the fear-mongering concept is not new in America. I mean, Americans have been fear-mongering immigrants forever, especially those south of the border. I've not seen anyone fear-monger Canadians yet. I'm waiting for that day to come. And Canadians do cross the border regularly. And if you talk to people who live in border communities and talk to some people that grew up on border communities in Canada and had the opportunity to actually talk to some folks that live on the borders of Texas and Texas and California a few times, it's a very different mentality in those about that type of stuff. My favorite story on the Canadian border, my friend who lives on the New York border, Canada, is the regular appearances of people from New York going into Canada to drink because it's a lower drinking age.
Oh, really?
19, legal drinking age. Ah. So not surprising, a whole lot of illegal Americans, if you want to call it illegal Americans, make their way across the border, beyond border checks to go get booze. On the flip side, the hunters, not surprising in some of these border communities where hunting is actually a big part of their industry, where people used to trade fur and still do fur and meat products back and forth over land.
Okay.
We're talking about, I'm not talking about hunting grounds like, you know, any of the state parks in Massachusetts. I'm talking like barren wasteland type of hunting ground situation.
Yeah.
All of the wild situation, folks. So where there's pretty much nobody can police you anyway. It's called a wild. So I've learned over the years when I talk to different folks that live in different places, what people see in the news or what people in Quincy or Boston, anyone that lives around here's attitude about stuff is very different from other people who have more regular engagement living in a border community regarding issues of undocumented. And then the irony is that it's not just people from the United States that come, people who come to the United States, but also vice versa, depending on the economic situation they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's variable. So every case is different. And I like to again say, it's not illegal to, a court of law says it's illegal.
Gotcha. Okay. There you go. We're approaching the end of the hour here, unfortunately, but can we talk a little bit about maybe reopening the state house?
Well, some ideas were floated in Sales News Service regarding perhaps requiring vaccination cards and whatnot, the same as the city of Boston, requiring mask mandates and so forth. I think as we come onto the bottom side of Omicron, I think there'll be more decisions made by the leadership team regarding a public opening. On the administrative staffing level, we've already putting together a schedule among the staff regarding rotational basis. I do not want my entire staff to be out of commission simultaneously. I understand people's desire to reopen, but I have no personal interest on all my staff getting sick at once. So we're going to try to do some rotational basis on staffing in my office to reduce the chance of everyone being ill at the same time. And that's, you guys can all speak for yourselves, but that's me. And I know people are going to be upset by that, but hey, I got an office to manage. I got a thing to run. So if I got non-functioning staff because they're sick with COVID, maybe if God forbid they get really, really sick, that hurts my ability to help you because, you know, I need help working like everyone else. If I go down very sick, you know, then your representation also goes down with my illness.
Right.
And I worked through a lot of illnesses in my lifetime, and people who have dealt with me in pre-COVID events have seen me kind of limping around. Probably should not been near people, quite honestly. Now that we live in a COVID world, I retrospect should have not been going to all these events.
Right.
With laryngitis and heavy coughing and swollen eyes to things. I will be definitely changing my behavior from here on in about going to places while being ill. So we are working on the schedule among ourselves and the staff, on my staff level, to ensure that we'll have coverage. No, question is who's going to want to visit us.
Well, that's true too. Yeah, because there is, you know, the day-to-day business, but then there's the travel, the tourism business too.
Yeah, majority of folks that come through the state house during the months of April to July, and then essentially end of September, right into early November, are tourists.
Sure.
That is the super majority of folks during those warmer periods. August tends to be a bit slower because it's August. But you know, during the warm months, it is just one of winters. And even among regular folks who do business at the State House, how many of them are going to be able to want to go see us in the building? Now we've adapted this type of work format that we're doing here. Are there going to be meetings coming in from various industry folks and other government affairs lobbyists, activists, mm-hmm. and so forth? I mean, we have a lot of people walking in the building, dropping off flyers, people trying to get improv meetings on the spot outside of scheduling. People have just walked in, trying to get a meeting because they're just taking a shot, right? Yeah. Maybe I have a gap in the schedule. Of course, interacting with other people's offices, we're in a very closed space. And, obviously we're not trying to get each other sick as well. Mm-hmm. I don't want to find ourselves infecting another office and then suddenly, the person only has one staffer or two staffers and both of them are now down with COVID for some time period. But obviously we don't want to do that to anybody. That's something that's, very much in my consideration. I do not want to infect other people.
Yeah.
That is one of the things I really work hard at to avoid being infected. And if so, try not to get something else.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think there's been a sea change in the way the American public is going to deal with any illnesses going forward.
No, I hope so. I'm not joking. I mean, people who remember me pre-COVID knows that I've shown up half dead to stuff. I would not be doing that anymore.
Right.
If I do, it's going to be like quick, very quick hellos and goes from a distance, perhaps. But I mean, I'm an idiot that way. I mean, I was always brought up that, you can get your ass out of your bed, you can get to someplace no matter how much mucus is coming out of you at the moment. I am, and I'm not getting younger either, folks. So I am really, honestly, whenever we get through whatever we're going through now with COVID. Right. It's definitely good. I would definitely have a habit change in trying to not become a problem for other people regarding not feeling well.
Yeah. Real quick, I know there's another Republican gubernatorial candidate making an announcement today. So the race is starting to shape up a little more interestingly than it was last week.
Oh, well, I saw a couple of articles in the Globe about potential folks. I didn't realize one finally came to the surface.
There's a Rentham businessman, the name of Dowdy, I think, that's making an announcement today.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that yet. I mean, I saw, a guy from Wareham. I saw a guy from the former U.S. Attorney General Ewing. I mean, there were a lot of names floated out there in the last 4 weeks. My inside baseball thing is that I'm fully aware that, the Republican Party membership, the state committee, as well as the governor's folks and others, looking to create a competitive Republican primary. They do mm-hmm. not want to walk through primary for Jeff Diehl. So, this is a state that encourages primaries, believe it or not, particularly for open seats, and unchallenged primaries are extraordinarily rare in this state.
Yep.
So I'm not surprised. And it's a rare opportunity because this is an unusual campaign environment. And I know people are now saying to yourselves, well, Maurice's got it in the bag. I'm like, the curse of the attorney general, the curse of the state treasurers, a different kind of environment. And just like other races, as probably were seen over the years, we've been observing this a long time, a few moments can change the entire dynamic mm-hmm. of a campaign.
Yeah, just ask Howard Dean.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. A few moments can change a campaign. And I'm not saying that anybody is going to beat Maura Healey. I do think she is the clear favorite on paper. I mean, it is difficult on paper. But once the campaign season gets moving through the year, things may change. I mean, we don't know if there's going to be another massive COVID spike. Maybe COVID goes down. Supply chains may have a different impact on the economy. Maybe crime goes up for whatever reason, crime goes down for whatever reason. I mean, this, none of us could have foreseen all the events in 2021. So much was going on at once in the midst of the pandemic, 2020 and 2021. When you look at those 2 years combined, so much was happening in the world beyond just COVID. And it had ripple effects in politics, not just on the presidential level, but right down the chain, county, state, and municipal levels too, regarding everything in life. I cannot not see why people shouldn't take a shot at it if they think they are in capability to do so. And the Republican Party is no different from the Democratic Party regarding open seat opportunity. Every person who's interested in running for office looks at open seat and need to survive a primary to do it. And, you know, people start trying to recruit people to go ahead and make a run for it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think the papers are available starting February 15th. The primary is September 6th, I believe.
Yeah. We're still waiting for that primary date to be finalized. The Senate right now is going to should start debate soon. Looking at the time on my laptop right here, they should be starting debate soon on the supplemental budget, the $55 million on COVID testing and masks and PPE that for schools. They're including there is the September 6th primary date. So hopefully they'll be resolved quickly today and. We get something at governor's desk by next week, and then papers should be printed and hopefully ready by February 15th.
Right.
Hopefully. Because the papers may come in a little late, but due dates won't change on the other end.
Right. So you have less time if it's delayed. Yep.
I would prefer to have adequate time to get my 150, please.
Sure. Anything else, Ted, today, Tacky?
No, that's all I got for now. I mean, you know, all I can say is that things are getting better slowly. But the world around us keeps changing. End of January comes, February begins, and we get through another month and see where we are. Chinese New Year starts on February 1st. Lunar New Year, so it'll be the year of the tiger coming up. So I think by the time we see you next, it'll be the start of a new Lunar New Year.
Very good. Yeah, here in Quincy, it's a virtual celebration this year by Quincy Eastern Resources, February the 20th, I believe it's Sunday.
Yes, and they have like a website, and I think QATV is helping them out on that as well. And virtual is not the same.
No.
I do think it's still important to recognize these celebrations, even though it's a bit truncated and it's not quite the same as seeing things in person, but I still believe that it's good to remind folks and also to celebrate the best we can separate. I mean, Chinese New Year for us and the family is a Zoom call this Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So we have a global Zoom call coming up this Saturday night.
Well, Happy New Year. Gong Hei Fa Choy. Am I getting that right?
Gong Hei Fa Choy. Silently in Philo. Gong Hei Fa Choy.
How do we get a hold of you, Tacky?
Well, 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. The staff tells me you guys are definitely just picking a button and leaving a message. So thank you very much for doing that. And thank you for leaving your phone number. thank you. It is important. We need a phone number, folks.
That's not magic.
I don't magically know where your phone number is. Tacky.chan, TACKEY.CHAN at mahouse.gov. That's the email. And I mean, email is somewhat under control at the moment. And then State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook page. We do put some interesting stuff up for links and some information, and some pictures and graphics that you may find useful. And we're going to have an executive session public hearing on Monday the 31st. It'll be my final hearing in executive session prior to Joint Lieutenant reporting deadline on the 2nd. So if you guys want to be bored to tears a little bit, watching us read our report on what we're doing. You're welcome to join us at 1 p.m. Obviously, tackychan.org. Tackychan.org is basically a reference number. We're going through a website update, so you may see some links come on and off. And next month or so, staff and I were discussing the fact that, you know, we haven't done link updates in a while and contact numbers and websites. And some people actually do change their websites and things like that. So we need to do some updating. So you may see some pages coming on and off the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, sounds good. Meantime, watch out for the snowstorm, and we'll chat in February.
Yeah, be safe, be well, and we'll see you in February. And maybe we'll see a Groundhog's Day, depending on how it goes.
Sounds good. Let's hope he predicts a quick spring, because I think people are just sick and tired.
I agree.
Okay. All right, thanks again, Tacky.
Take care.